This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This is a classic Radio EcoShock replay from 2019. Alex will be back next week.
Astounding new science finds the amount of land and people exposed to sea level rise has been wildly underestimated. At least 100 million more people will be flooded out this century. And a lot of that new seawater is coming from melting ice at the poles. Professor Jonathan Bamber is a specialist in the Great Ice Melt, providing data used by scientists around the world. Dr. Bamber is from the Bristol Glaciology Center at UK's University of Bristol. We reached Jonathan Bamber in Toulouse, France. Jonathan, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to speak on the program.
Well, your work is critical when trying to understand how radically coastlines will change for this generation and the next. But first, let's talk about this astounding new paper in Nature Communications titled New Elevation Data Triples Estimates of Global Vulnerability to Sea Level Rise and Coastal Flooding. And of course, that is not news for you. What did you get from the lead author, Scott Culp's presentation at the annual meeting of the American Geophysical Union last year?
Well, I saw the title of the talk in the program, and I thought, well, that's a must-go-to session. I've done a lot of work with something called digital elevation models. That's land surface topography, mainly derived from satellite data, but sometimes from ground-based data as well. It's a very interesting study. What they've done is looked at the most commonly used digital elevation model for determining global land surface elevations, and it's a model called SRTM, which is the Shuttle Radar Topographic Mission, and it was flown about 15 years ago or something like that, and it's one of the most commonly used data. It's not the only one, but it's the one that is used by many groups to assess the vulnerability of coastal communities to sea level rise and coastal flooding and other natural hazards in coastal areas. And they looked at the accuracy of SRTM in coastal areas and produced a new DEM that they've called Coastal DEM, which improves the representation in coastal areas. That in essence, there's a bias in SRTM, a high bias. In other words, in coastal areas, SRTM is giving you elevations that are typically a few meters too high. And they've corrected that bias, more or less. You know, I mean, there are inaccuracies in all global data sets, but they've certainly reduced the bias and reduced the random error, the what's called the standard deviation, the random errors in the DEM. And by doing that, they discovered that, or one of the conclusions of their study was that it's around about three times more people are going to be exposed to coastal flooding than was predicted using the SRTM DEM. That's the kind of headline of that study.
It sounds to me like the NASA's shuttle radar data was accepting things like treetop levels in forests and building tops in urban areas as though that was ground level. Is that correct?
Well, look, I mean, we've known that for a long time because one of the uses for digital elevation models is to define watersheds and to determine where water is going to flow in, not in coastal areas, but in inland areas. And so if you look at somewhere like Amazon Forest, well, SRTM is actually of limited value there because it's just measuring the canopy top elevation, not what's called the bare earth elevation. And obviously in urban areas or heavily vegetated areas, particularly like rainforests, SRTM doesn't penetrate the surface or buildings, and it doesn't measure what's called the bare earth elevation. So we have known that, but I guess it's been quite a challenge to improve on that product. And it's not everywhere that you get a bias. I mean, obviously, if you have some very open coastal area with low-lying vegetation and no urban development, then the bias is likely to be quite low.
You know, what surprises me too, though, is that apparently we in the public and policymakers didn't know that this error that's known in scientific circles was happening. And now it sort of comes to us as a big shock. Well, you mean you didn't know what the actual elevation of the land was in so many key areas?
Well, look, that's the scientific process. I mean, we're constantly, you know, improving on our understanding and knowledge of all parts of the Earth system and, you know, everything that's going on. You know, I mean, Voyager 2's just gone outside of the solar system, hasn't it? You know, I mean, everything is, we're constantly improving our understanding and, you know, chipping away at some of the uncertainties. And, yeah, we understood that there are uncertainties in SRTM. What they have done in this study is they've quantified them and they've shown that there is really quite a significant bias in particular coastal areas and areas where there's heavy urban development and lots of vegetation. And they've quantified the effect of that on the impacts on populations. I think that's the kind of the big advance that they've done in this study, which, you know, does, as I say, it increases the number of people that they are expected to be at risk of, let's say, annual flood events or that are going to lie below the mean high water tide level by about a factor of 3, which is quite a big difference. So in the study that we did, which I think we're going to talk about a little bit later, we had an estimate for the number of people that we thought would be affected or potentially displaced by a 2-meter sea level rise, and the value we came up with, which came from the literature prior to this study, was 190 million people. Well, that is now, according to this study, more like 600 million. And to put that in perspective, 600 million, that is the 1/10 of the population of the planet right now, or roughly. You know, that's a lot of people. It's twice the population of the U.S.
Yeah, no, not all those people are going to have to just run away from where they are. I mean, they're talking about annual flood events are possible at the start of things, and I think people will adapt somewhat, but it's still pretty shocking that the ocean is going to start flooding into so many people's lives in this century.
You're absolutely right. I think we should be clear that we're not saying that 600 million people are going to have to leave their homes, you know, straight away, but if you think that your house is going to be flooded like once a year, that's, you know, that's not going to be very pleasant. It's not going to be much fun. It's going to make life fairly difficult. And in addition, I mean, there will be communities that will have to move inland. They'll have to migrate from coastal areas because they'll become uninhabitable. One of the consequences of sea level rise is what's called salinification. So that is basically the intrusion of salt water into freshwater groundwater in coastal areas. Once that happens, and once you don't have a natural freshwater supply in a coastal area, well, then, you know, it becomes very difficult to continue living there. So, I mean, there will be migration inland. There will be people that are displaced, but it's not 600 million, for example.
Well, even when we do get a better estimate of what land is really within 2 meters or about 6 feet of the current sea level, we need to know how much that sea level will change and by when, and that is where your work contributes a lot. How much of coming sea level rise will come from the melting ice world, the cryosphere?
Look, that's the $64 million question, which we'd all like to answer in one way or another. And I don't think we've got that long. I could spend several hours trying to explain, you know, give you an answer to that question. There are various different ways we can tackle that question. There are several factors that influence sea level rise, and there are three that are sort of very important. There's one which is thermal expansion of the ocean. So when the ocean warms, it expands, sea level goes up. And that's something that we understand pretty well. And there are uncertainties around how much heat will be absorbed by the ocean over the next century, but those uncertainties are not so great. So we have a pretty good handle on thermal expansion, okay? And that, you know, it's going to be on the order of 20 to 30 centimeters or of that order. It depends on the climate warming scenario, the trajectory we follow. But, you know, we've got a fairly good handle on that. The second component is melting of glaciers, mountain glaciers around the world. So that's all the ice outside of Antarctica and Greenland. Now, if you melted all of the glaciers, that's like all the glaciers in the Rockies, the Andes, the Himalayas, in the Arctic outside of Greenland, everything, that would contribute about 45 centimeters to sea level. Now, it's not all going to disappear by 2100, but maybe in a what we call a business as usual type scenario, maybe half of that, about 20 centimeters, will come from glaciers around the world. The third component is the ice sheets. Now, the ice sheets contain 99.5% of all the ice on the planet. If you melted Antarctica and Greenland tomorrow and you dumped them in the ocean, you'd raise global sea level by 65 meters. Now, to people in the US, that's, over 200 feet. So the ice sheets have the potential to have a really big impact on sea level rise over the next century. But the problem with the ice sheets is that they're actually not particularly well understood. Their response to climate change and to changes in what we call external forcing, in other words, like what the oceans do and what the atmosphere does, are not that well understood. We have models of ice sheets which are relatively sophisticated, but they don't include certain important processes, and there is a debate about what processes are important and what aren't. And so there's a large uncertainty surrounding what the ice sheets are going to do over the next century, or actually next few centuries. So rather than take a modeling approach, what we did was a method, an approach called structured expert judgment. I guess I should explain a little bit what that is.
What is that?
Yeah. It's a method that's been used, if I sort of introduce it, a method that's been used very extensively for assessing the risks and the uncertainties surrounding what are called low probability, high impact events. So examples of those are that there's about, I think, is it sort of 50 or 60,000 people that live on the island of Montserrat. In the center of Montserrat is a volcano, an active volcano. So it's absolutely critical for those people living there to have some handle on what the likelihood of an eruption is in the next few days, you know, so you can assess whether you need to evacuate those people. So volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, the risk of things like what's called rad waste, radioactive waste leakage, dam failures, all of these sorts of things that are actually, we have some understanding about what processes influence these things. You know, we know something about mechanics of volcanoes and earthquakes, but the models are not adequate for giving you predictions. And that's the position we're in with ice sheets. And so what you do is you take as many of the sort of world-leading experts that have published or have an understanding of this particular field, you bring them together, and we organize two workshops, one in the US and one in Europe. You go through a series of questions which you know the answer to, but they don't. And that's what's called the sort of calibration phase. That's the structured bit to the expert judgment. So what we're doing by asking these questions is determining the expert's ability to assess their own uncertainty in something. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And so this is a process that can be applied to climate change and particularly to things like sea level rise, for example. Now, in 2013, you and W.P. Aspinall published a paper that used expert judgment assessment, and you said in that paper that you suggested a conceivable risk of sea level rise of greater than a meter by 2100, but your latest on the subject, published in April 2019 in PNAS, says, quote, "Our findings support the use of scenarios of 21st century global total sea level rise exceeding 2 meters for planning purposes." Why did you go from talking about 1 meter to 2 meters in just 6 years?
Yeah, that is a very good question. And the first thing I should say is those numbers are not mine. I didn't generate them. They came from this structured expert judgment exercise where we pool the expertise of the world's leading experts. In the most recent exercise, it's about 23 people from North America and Europe, where we pulled their expertise and we asked them what they think their best judgments. It's not a guess, it's a judgment of what they think the ice sheets are going to do. And why have the numbers changed? Why have they effectively doubled? There have been some studies in the last 5 or 6 years that have suggested, that imply that, in particular, the Antarctic ice sheet is more vulnerable to warming, is could respond faster than we previously believed, in essence. There was an influential paper published in 2016 by two US scientists, Rob DeConta and Dave Pollard, where they introduced a mechanism called the marine ice cliff instability. Now, the details don't matter, but what they found was that by introducing this mechanism, which is theoretically entirely reasonable. You know, from theory, it totally makes sense. It just hasn't really been observed in the present-day ice sheets. By including it, they were able to reproduce past ice sheet sort of changes in volume during previous warm periods, in particular a period called the Pliocene, about 3.5 million years ago. And including this marine ice cliff instability mechanism in their model made, in particular, the East Antarctic much more sensitive to climate warming than we than models had suggested previously. And I think part of the higher numbers that we're coming up with now is due to the experts' belief that this is a plausible mechanism. And one thing I should stress about the numbers that you quoted, the 1 meter and the 2 meter, those are not what we call the most likely scenario. They're not the mean or the median estimates from the experts. They're the upper tails, the 5% probability, what some policymakers might call the worst case scenario. You know, the relatively low probability. I mean, not that low. It's a 1 in 20 probability. Low probability, high impact. But what is indicated from our analysis is that mechanism has made the experts feel that the Antarctic ice sheet could potentially contribute more than we previously believed to sea level rise. And I think there's a second factor that has quite strongly influenced expert judgment in the last 6 years, which is that our observations of the ice sheets, and that's an area that I've worked in quite a bit over the last few years, are quite short. They're only about the sort of high-quality observations from satellites. They're only 25 to 30 years long in terms of the length of the record, and that's quite short in terms of a climate record. It's quite short to determine whether you're seeing a trend or just natural variability in the system. But when you look at that record, mass loss from West Antarctica and from Greenland has roughly been steadily increasing over time. And many of the models of West Antarctica and Greenland haven't really predicted that behavior. And so, again, I think what that's suggesting to the experts is that actually, in particular, Greenland and West Antarctica are a bit more sensitive to climate forcing than we previously thought. And I think if you combine those two factors together, it's given the experts the sort of the view, the judgment that both ice sheets, well, all three, there's Greenland and then Antarctica is usually split into West Antarctica and East Antarctica, that all three of them are more sensitive to climate change than we thought, say, back in 2012 when we did the previous study.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, your nonprofit program on climate and the environment. I am Alex Smith. My guest is Professor Jonathan Bamber from the University of Bristol. We're talking about the great melting ice world and seas rising around hundreds of millions of people. So I guess the Climate Central study on the millions exposed to sea level rise looks at several scenarios, and the worst combines continued high emissions as now with what they call Antarctic instability. And I guess that's what you were just talking about, the Antarctic instability?
It's exactly that, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, the acronym is MICI, Marine Ice Cliff Instability, which was, I mean, proposed a while back, but the first kind of really important paper on it was published in 2016, so that's quite recent.
Jonathan, you work on calculating ice loss from places like Greenland, and a group of scientists, including James Hansen and Andrew Glickson, are watching that cold blob of meltwater collecting south of Greenland. Do you think an onslaught of colder fresh water from the glaciers could change ocean currents or even the weather in places like your home in the UK?
Okay, so that again is an area that we in my group have worked on quite a bit. And the technical term, or the term oceanographers use, is the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, the AMOC. And there have been quite a lot of studies looking at whether the strength of the AMOC, which releases a lot of heat in the polar North Atlantic just south of Greenland and keeps Northwest Europe much warmer than it would be without it, whether that could be shut down or whether it could be weakened by lots of melt from the Greenland ice sheet. And I think the jury is still out on that one. I think the latest evidence, I mean, we published a paper about 3 years ago on this, is that it looks like the Greenland ice sheet in the next decades could have some impact on the AMOC. It seems unlikely that it's going to shut down, that you're going to have a, you know, something like the sort of day after tomorrow type scenario where, you know, suddenly, I don't know, the Hudson River freezes over or whatever it was that they had in that film. The evidence right now suggests that you're not going to have a very dramatic, what we call in jargon, a tipping point in the climate system. But there does seem to be some reasonably compelling evidence to suggest that the AMOC could weaken as a consequence of increased freshwater fluxes from Greenland, Arctic ice caps, and also from the rapidly melting Arctic sea ice as well, which is putting fresh water back into the Arctic Ocean and North Atlantic.
The other really strange thing to me, Jonathan Bamber, is that as the ice is lost from these continents and they lose mass, which you measure even from satellite measurements, then the sea level rise right around Greenland and Antarctica might actually go down. Is that true?
Yeah, that is a bit of an odd one. You know, I'm a professor in university, so I teach undergraduates, and one of my favorite topics is this. It's called self-gravitation, and because it's really counterintuitive, and I think, you know, the students, once they get it, they find it really sort of just incredible that this sort of thing happens. But so the sea, the surface of the sea follows something called the geoid, the shape of the geoid. The geoid is just the gravity field around the Earth. So the surface of the ocean is not entirely flat. It goes up and down over long distances, depending on how much mass is underneath the ocean or how the gravity field of the Earth it changes as a function of location, because it's not constant. You know, where you have a lot more mass, the gravity is a little bit stronger, and you get water being pulled towards that area. And so it accumulates, it sort of piles up in areas of stronger gravity. Where the gravity field gets weaker, then the opposite happens. Now, if you take a load of ice, and we're talking, I mean, huge volumes of ice, at the minute, the Greenland ice sheet is losing something like 280 to 300 gigatons of ice. A gigaton is 10 to the 9 tons. 1 gigaton is a cubic kilometer of ice.
Is that annually?
Annually. And so it's losing, let's say, around about 300 cubic kilometers of ice a year. You know, huge. That's a huge mass. So if you take that off the land and you stick it in the ocean, then the gravity field over Greenland itself actually goes down, gets weaker. And so the water, instead of piling up around Greenland, is sort of does the opposite. It sinks. And so you're absolutely right. What you originally said is that sea level will go down close to Greenland. And what's called in the far field, thousands of kilometers away from Greenland, it actually goes up by more than the sort of global mean as a consequence. So it's quite a counterintuitive process. There's another really wacky thing that happens as well. You know, the Earth is spinning on its axis, and if you take that the mass off Greenland and you stick it in the ocean, then based on this principle or law, which is conservation of angular momentum, then the axis of rotation of the Earth to change to conserve angular momentum. Does that make sense?
Not totally yet.
Yeah, well, okay. Do you know what a gyroscope is?
Yes.
Yeah. So if you have a little gyroscope spinning on a table, and it's spinning around, and it stays upright because of the wheel that's spinning around, which is weighted. Now, if you get a piece of gum, and you stick that gum not on the axis of rotation, but you stick it on the side of the gyroscope a little bit, let's say two-thirds of the way down, then the gyroscope is going to tilt over towards where that gum is because you've changed the distribution of mass on the gyroscope. And to conserve this angular momentum, the rotating momentum, the axis of rotation, you know, your spinning point, needs to change. I mean, the other example is, you know, if you take a bicycle wheel and you spin it round, and then you put your finger on the end, it, you know, it tips down. It's exactly the same thing. And we're talking, I mean, very small changes in the angle of rotation of the Earth, but they're large enough to be measured by accurate geodetic instruments and to actually change the distribution of water in the longitudinal east-west directions.
On the larger scale, I am hearing rumbles from august German scientists and institutions that the current scientific method and the political system for handling climate change is not working. Just this week, IPCC stalwart Dr. Robert Watson is reporting the Paris Agreement will not slow down global warming. So on a personal level, Jonathan Bamber, is it time to freak out about climate change?
That's a difficult question to answer. I would say, in a way, no. I think we should have freaked out about climate change 30 years ago, personally. We're very late to the table on this one. You know, in the last 30 years, over half of the CO2 emissions since the Industrial Revolution have been emitted. So, I mean, that's done and dusted. You know, we can't go back in time. But I think, absolutely, we should have been. And to be fair, many scientists, including people like Jim Hance and actually a number of other eminent scientists in the US, have been shouting out about this message since the 1980s. I don't know. Something seems to have happened in the last year or so. I think a number of different things and factors have come into it. But the public and the politicians sort of really do seem to be getting the message now. So we're having an election in the UK, as I think you probably know, on the 12th of December, so just like a few weeks away now. And one of the major election manifesto items by the Labour Party is related to climate change, because they think it matters to the public. Now, that's the first time that that's been really high on the agenda, you know, right at the top of the agenda in the UK. And I should say in Germany, issues around the environment are seem to be number one in terms of political choices. So I think we are starting to get a message, but crikey, we really need to crack on because time is very short.
We have been speaking with ice expert Jonathan Bamber. He is a professor at the University of Bristol, UK, and a source of authoritative papers on the disappearing ice world on planet Earth. And to find out more, you can use links to the science we just talked about and some of the media coverage in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you for generously sharing your time with us, Jonathan.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Please pass this program on to others. You can find easy play buttons in the blog for each program at ecoshock.org or listen on SoundCloud. Retweet my show tweet. Reading short news accounts is one thing or a few seconds on TV, but hearing the scientists at the source, it's another. That's one thing we do here at Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is a classic radio EcoShock replay from 2019. Alex will be back next week.
It's all alive.
The planet does not work just as a physical system. That reality needs to become fundamental to the way we pursue science and derive policy recommendations. Biology must become central to climate change science and policy formulation.
So said the grand old voice for living things, Thomas E. Lovejoy. When it comes to preparing for the future here on Earth, physics is important, chemistry and geology too. But if we forget that this is a living planet, we won't get it right. The prestigious journal Science Advances brings it all home with an editorial on the marriage of life, life sciences, and climate change. It introduces a special collection of papers just in time for the 25th Conference of the Parties, COP25, in Madrid, Spain. To sum it up, we reached a lead author in the editorial titled Navigating Transformation of Biodiversity and Climate. Dr. Pablo A. Marquette is a professor at Catholic University of Chile and principal investigator for the Institute of Ecology and Biodiversity. From Santiago, Chile, Pablo Marquette, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, well, for a dozen years I've been interviewing scientists about two major crises, almost thinking of them as separate, the climate change and disappearing species. But only recently guests have started to tie the two together, both as problems and as solutions. Why did Science Advances embark on this collection of scientific works from the last couple of years?
Well, it all boils down to a couple of key facts. One is that I was made an editor of Science Advances not too long ago, and at the same time, Chile was organizing the Conference of the Parties this year, but it was moved to Madrid, by the way. And then is the issue that we have come to realize that we cannot solve problems which are multidimensional and completely interdisciplinary just having disciplinary approaches. The very old saying that the world has problems and universities departments. I mean, it doesn't work. We have to work with the problems, and the problems have to be addressed multidisciplinary ones.
Forest activists and champions for endangered species complain they have been relegated to second seats by the global worry about climate change. Are they right?
Well, you have to recognize that species and ecosystems, they are part of the big picture, and the big picture includes climate, biodiversity, and all the interactions between them. This two big compartments. So the issue is not that we have to be stuck just talking about the components of the system. We have to think hard about the connections, the dynamics between these two systems. I mean, you go back to the history of Earth, you will see that all the changes that we have been going through in the last 600 million years have been, to a large extent, driven by changes in biodiversity. And biodiversity change, the climate change biodiversity, and they keep going around in this kind of circular causality as a prominent ecologist, Evelyn Hutchinson, once said.
Pablo, please give us a tour of some of the papers in this latest collection by Science Advances, just as the delegates are heading for COP25 in Spain, and take as long as you'd like to talk to us about what are in these papers.
Right. This was kind of a curated position of ideas. You see, and it includes new material, but also some papers that were published in the journal during the last year and that we curated because we thought it would make sense to have them for conveying the message. So we start up with a paper by Disenbaugh on the recurrence of extreme events and very extreme ones that will be predicted if we just keep doing things like a business as usual and with the commitment that nations do in order to abate climate change. They're not very ambitious so far, so if we keep in that path, models anticipate that we will be hit by very unusual, very hard events in weather. I mean, very extreme temperatures and very extreme kind of droughts and so on. So that set the stages, and then we go into a couple of papers that really look at the interaction between vegetation, the soil, and the atmosphere. You know, and they make the point that there is sort of a continuum, but also the complexity of this system, because you have the soil with a ceiling of bacteria and fungi, and they interact with the plants, and the plants interact with the atmosphere. And there is a carbon fixation that actually promotes a particular type of a microbe. Microbes also have a saying in terms of the decomposition rate and the fluxes of carbon from the soil to the atmosphere. So depending on the amount of water that you might have, this process more or less intense. And there is a sort of complexity and feedback between these systems. So we found out that there is a continuum from the atmosphere to the soil that is mediated by plants and that there are very complicated feedbacks in between. So then we go into papers that talk about experimental evidence regarding the impact of warming on plant species. And in particular, there is a paper by Panetta and John Harte where they show that experimentally, how is the impact of artificial warming in a prairie, which is in a place in Colorado, and they show that warming affects the seed bank of the particular species, and that promotes the extinction of this species of plant in meadows. So this is experimental evidence that climate can induce extinction of plant species at a very local scale. We have a couple of papers on the importance of marine conservation, of a marine ecosystem, how you can improve the creation of a system of protected areas to be resilient to climate change, the importance of enforcing management plans for these protected areas, the importance of considering climate change when doing that, and also some alternative in terms of adaptive management of protected areas. So you can create protected areas when it's needed, and then when needed, and then you can move those protected areas to different regions because of climate change also changes and its impact also changes. So it's a very interesting, provocative paper. And also, there is another interesting paper on the implications of climate change for fisheries in the sea, and how it's predicted that if we keep the path we are going, we will anticipate losses in biomass and revenues, and that if we enforce the Paris Agreement, there will be a lot of benefits in terms of biodiversity and in terms of revenues of the economy. And then there is a paper, this is a very interesting one, I'm co-author of that one too, and this one is by Brian Enquist group, and it's a paper that compiles a huge database of millions of records of plants across the world, shows that the most common pattern is that most species are rare, and that there are very kind of a well-defined hotspots of rarity, and that most of those hotspots of rarity coincide with areas that will experience accelerated climate change in the future. So that will likely endanger increased extinction probability of a lot of rare species. And then we have very important papers which make the point that there are solutions to the crisis, the climate crisis we are facing. And those solutions, I like to call them, are based on biodiversity. Biodiversity is part of the solution, and it's also part of the problem because we are part of biodiversity, and we don't usually recognize that, and that's part of the problem. So biodiversity solutions means that we can change or use different ecosystems or nature to actually mitigate emissions and potentiate the capture of carbon. And those are the so-called nature-based solutions or biodiversity solutions. So you, for example, you can restore or you can revegetate areas with native vegetation, so you can improve the growth and the capture from the atmosphere. You can change agriculture. You can eventually replace nitrogen-based fertilizers with other kind of fertilizers coming from the, suppose, the animal industry, like stearicol or other stuff, and more biocarbon can improve the fertility of the soil. And if you don't use that much nitrogen fertilizer, you will reduce the emission of nitrogen oxide to the atmosphere, which is a greenhouse gas. So you can improve silviculture to plantations. You can make longer rotations. You can also create or improve the urban forest, for example, or restore wetlands, which is a huge thing in terms of carbon. So we can do a lot of these solutions that will have a lot of benefits for biodiversity, for ecosystem functioning, and for us. I mean, social benefits, better cities, more friendly with biodiversity and with human well-being. And that's a paper by Farghione, who actually do these climate solutions for the United States. And there's another paper by Gingerstein on New Deal for Nature, where they emphasize the importance of protected areas in terms of securing areas that have a lot of carbon already accumulated, and also improve those areas to up to a 30% of the world, so we can assure and protect a lot of the forests in the world that are capturing carbon. So that's another kind of a biodiversity solution. So that's kind of an overview. So the main thing is that biodiversity and climate are highly connected through history. We live in the climate that we, biodiversity, create. And so we have to work on providing solutions using biodiversity.
Yes, the paper with Brian Enquist and yourself startled me a little bit because I think we picture that there's a main list of living things and then there's a few rare species out there somewhere. But the map of species looks different than that. It really puts the word diversity in biodiversity. There's a lot of rare things in the makeup of life.
Yes, indeed. You know, in terms of the band issue, I mean, the distribution of abundance or how many rare versus common species are there, there were two major schools, the one that said that there was a lot of rare species, which was pretty much the British school that started with Ronald Fisher, and then the American school saying that, you know, most of the species are relatively common. And I think that the evidence last years are becoming very, very strong, showing that a lot of these species are rare. And if you think about that, if you try to reflect, why is that? Well, it looks like there is a lot of turnover of rare species, and they're coming and going, coming and going. And a species, actually, at the end of the day, is a strategy. It does something. So we it looks like we have a huge amount of variability down there in the strategies that can eventually have their moment of glory, you know, but they are there and eventually they can move up to the main kind of a role and increase in abundance and become sort of more dominant and so on. So it's very interesting thinking about this when there are some changes in climate. So I think it's a very, very important message to show that world scale, most species are rare.
Yes, nature is a great experimenter, and we depend on the width of that experiment for adapting to whatever happens here on Earth, and Earth can be a changing place. Pablo, what is the situation for rare and endangered species in your home country of Chile?
Well, we have as many, as you know, a lot located in the so-called hotspot of Mediterranean Chile. That encompasses a little bit to the north and south of the temperate rainforest. So this is a hot spot because it has a lot of endemics, and also because almost 70% of it is being highly kind of more by human action. So I'm afraid that a lot of the species might be going extinct, and we will never know. We haven't yet made a thorough kind of a catalog of what we have and where we have it. So things are not very kind of, I would say, optimistic in my sense for the Chilean biodiversity. We have a lot of land use changes. And one of the ecosystems that has been highly impacted is the freshwater. And that's a very kind of complicated story because water, you know, Chile is one of the few places in the world that has a market for water rights. So you buy them, you sell them. Most of the water rights are in the hands of big enterprises. And if you want to do an integral kind of management of anything, you find that you have many actors that you have to work with. And it's very difficult to put all of them in agreement at the same time. So it's a very complicated story in terms of biodiversity. And it's the fresh water is full of exotic species that have decimated the local fauna. And the big in central Chile, too, is that it's going to be hit very hard by climate change, and especially so in terms of the hydrological cycle. We are been going through a 10-year drought. The water is running out. It's affecting all the mining industry, which is one of the major industries in Chile. So we are going to have to do things in a different way. Otherwise, this is not going to be viable. And also, central Chile is where most of the fruit industry and agriculture is. So these are complex issues in the future.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from Santiago, Chile. Our guest is Professor Pablo Marquet. And we are discussing the links between disappearing species and climate change, as published in the journal Science Advances. Thomas Crowther was here on Radio EcoShock. He's from ETH Zurich, and he managed to count the world's trees, and then he called us to plant billions and billions more trees to draw down dangerous CO2 from the atmosphere. Do you see that as a real weapon in the battle to save a livable climate?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I think it's sensible. It's one of the biodiversity-based solutions or nature-based solutions. One of the papers in the collection by Fagione, they actually analyzed the potential of these solutions for the United States, and they claim that it might actually reduce the emission by 21%. So it's not small. In the case of Chile, the maximum potential for those solutions, according to another paper, is around 45 million tons of carbon. So that will probably make it or will be very close to be carbon neutral if we implement those. So revegetation, forestation, it has a lot of potential. But we have to make sure that we revegetate with native species, so we capitalize on the COP benefit.
So the entire hope of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change seems to assume an industrial solution to the industrial problem of greenhouse gases, and pretty well nothing has come of oil industry plans to capture carbon and pipe it back to old wells for permanent storage. Could we instead get enough drawdown of CO2 with biological solutions?
Yeah, I think the climate change and carbon pollution, so to speak, is a problem in nature, and only nature can solve it. And we are part of nature, so whatever we do is acting on it. But also, we can be smart. And being smart means that a machine that can draw carbon from the atmosphere and that work on solar energy. Well, that is a plant. You know, it was invented already, so we have to use it.
I think that understanding life as a key player in the climate is not so new. I think of David Beerling's classic book, The Emerald Planet, How Plants Changed Earth's History, or James Lovelock with the Gaia Hypothesis. Do you think the politicians and experts at COP25 have tuned in to this new connection yet, or are we stuck with just the numbers game of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere? What do you think?
Well, I think that there is some logic in reiteration. I mean, we have to rediscover the wheel several times until it becomes your wheel. And I think the politicians, some of them are really locked some views or solutions. And it takes a while to move them from that sort of attractor to a different one. And biodiversity-based solutions or nature-based solutions are becoming very big. It's being pushed by IPCC, a Working Group 3, IUCN, WWF, CNC. And so there's a lot of traction on that. And you know what? It's logical. The solution is very logical, and it has co-benefits. And one of the important co-benefits that is heavily emphasized by IUCN and also by the European Union is because the nature-based solution was adopted in the plan, in the European 2020 plan, is that it provides a lot of social benefits. So it makes us also happier. So, and I think that everything, all those components are connected, and we need healthier and very kind of a more, we have to strengthen the social texture of our society face climate change too and cooperate the problem. So nature-based solutions are kind of a low-hanging fruit for the problem.
And I think that somewhere in the brains of the public lurks a voice maybe saying, we will just farm the whole planet and develop it for ourselves. Who needs the rest? Who cares if these other things go away? Nature is messy anyway. What do you think about that?
Well, that's probably the source of all the problems we are facing as a society, is that we keep inventing reasons for not recognizing that we are part of nature, we are part of biodiversity, and there is nothing else than that, you know. So farming the whole thing for us, it will be disastrous. I mean, that farming and all those things are called a contribution of nature to people. If you emphasize one provision by nature, which is actually the soil fertility, so you can grow crops on it, you will lose the rest. If you lose the rest, eventually this is a boomerang that will hit you. So unless we enforce this, or we actually have to reconnect ourselves with nature, and in doing so, we will have to reconnect with ourselves. And more importantly, reflect on what is to be human. What is the meaning of what is the interesting part of being human and alive on this planet?
A journal like Science Advances used to publish a lot of studies with very dense scientific language, and the papers were for other scientists and maybe high-level government advisors, but not the public. But now, with the climate already destabilized and rumors things like the bees could disappear, a lot more people want to know what is happening. Pablo Marquette, have you seen a shift in scientific journals trying to reach a wider audience?
I've seen that there is a genuine and an important kind of attempt to do so. That's why they are a little bit kind of diversifying on doing this special collection, for example, for Science Advances. They really want to influence and really tackle society important issues. And the editorials you look at, they are supposed to be very wide, general, and try to seduce the lay person to actually get a handle on what is going on in the world regarding not only climate change, but that there are some other special on addiction, for example. And there was another one on the high seas that were kind of made to influence policy. So that's also what we wanted to do with this collection that will be show up at the COP25. Madrid. We hope that politicians and negotiators, people will actually read it and create a little bit of business of the importance of putting biodiversity and climate change in the same kind of room, so to speak.
Yes, it's a dual crisis, not just a single thing. Now, in your introduction to the Science Advances Special Collection, you and three colleagues write, quote, "Evidence suggests that the negative impacts of climate change can be kept under control if we collectively act and, critically, use biodiversity as part of the solutions we invent." I have to say that I am doubtful. In many places, governments are struggling to keep control of the streets, much less carbon. And when carbon taxes come out, sometimes there are riots. What is the evidence we can keep this warming under control?
Well, pretty much we are talking about nature-based solutions, and if you enforce nature-based solutions because they have co-benefit to biodiversity and to society, I mean, you will build more equal societies and more resilient ones. People will be happier. Right now in the streets in Santiago, there have been a huge rebellion of the society. Most of the people is out in the street marching for dignity after 30 years of living in a kind of a very predatory economic system. And so probably for this reivindication, I mean, climate is not a problem, important problem right now. The important problem is to have money to actually make it to the end of the month. In the long run, if you make happier people, you make people happier, you reconstruct the social network and the texture of the society, we will have a chance to act collectively and solve the big problems. But the thing is, the complexity is that all this is connected. I mean, economic systems, social systems, ecology, and so we have to have that big picture in mind and try to enforce or think on new ways to improve democracies, how to make them more representative, to make economic systems more human-based, and also to enforce the major things that make us human. And so we will be able to cooperate to solve the problem, but in the current state of businesses in the world, very difficult. But I keep my hopes high. I think we will do it.
There is no other choice. As we finish up here, what is next in the works of Pablo Marquette?
Well, a couple of things. We are trying to start doing a big analysis for the nature-based solution for Chile. And also I'm leading a biodiversity task force for the Ministry of Science in Chile, trying to update what we know about Chilean biodiversity in terms of climate change and where we can move on. And also I'm affiliated with a Complex System Science Institute, which is the Santa Fe Institute in the United States, and also the Complex System Institute in Valparaiso, Chile. So we keep thinking on the big picture and what is next for this socio-ecological system. And we realize we have to put a lot more efforts to make to connect the dots and to see how we can come out with solutions that will improve human well-being and have a lot of benefits to society and the rest of nature. So there are a lot of philosophy to study here, and I'm delving into it and also reflections to make. So we'll see. It's bad. I'm optimistic. I think we can pull it out.
From Santiago, we've been speaking with one of the leading scientists of Chile, Dr. Pablo Marquette. You can find links to his new work in Science Advances in my show blog at ecoshock.org or go to advances.sciencemag.org. Pablo, thank you for sharing your time and your thoughts with us.
Well, thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay.
This isn't easy radio. Thank you for your patience, for listening to the sources, for working out reality rather than accepting an advertising dream or a political slogan of who you should be. Reality is the key, and we can get there by participating in the world, by loving people, and by listening with two ears, science and wisdom. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening. Hang in there and keep on caring about our world.
As temples of power slip beneath the rising sea, you can never return to the way that was. You can never return to the place that was. Tell me tales of refugees from the tipping time, the poles revealed to the dance of the methane sign.